Well, it was a few years ago. Many people were talking about the return of Planet X into our solar system and nearby planet here. That was around May of 2003. Mark Hazelwood talked about it, of course, being the son of the late singer Lee Hazelwood, who sings one of our favorite songs, Some Velvet Morning, with Nancy Sinatra. And also Nancy Leader talked about Planet X. Did it come around? Many say it did not. Zachariah Sitchin, as you know, in his book, The 12th Planet, basically talks about a Planet X called Nibiru that comes around every 3,600 years. In a moment, our special guest tonight, Dr. Jason Rand, as we talk about the return of Planet X. That's on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jason Rand received his honorary PhD in the field of energy informative sciences from the Academy of Energy Informative Sciences, conducted with Moscow University in Russia. His contributions in the study and pursuit of extraterrestrial communications, research into UFO phenomena, cosmology, and his representing the United States at the first World UFO Congress in 1991 earned him distinctive recognition and his doctorate from their Russian Academy of Sciences in 1992. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Jason. How are you?
I'm fine, George, and thank you so very much for having me on your program tonight.
Our pleasure. You have done not only an incredible job in The Return of Planet X, your book, but the research that went into it. How long did it take you?
Well, the actual working mechanics probably started in 2001, and it wasn't until actually December of last year that we really rounded the corner, did the proofing on it, and felt comfortable with the fact that we had found all the information that was available at that time to incorporate into our text.
Jason, tonight we'll talk about your theories. We'll talk about some of the work of Zachariah Sitchin, because there may definitely be a tie-in here. Mm-hmm. The Book of Revelation, because you make reference to Wormwood. Let me get your take on, you know, a couple people who felt that Planet X was going to come rolling through in May of 2003. Why do you think they were wrong? At least I think they were wrong, because I didn't see it.
That's a pretty tricky question, but let's jump into it. Okay, number one, this is a very, very complex subject. It has many levels. It has opinions from one end of the yardstick to the other. And the subject itself almost sounds like science fiction, okay? Let me give you a brief description of what I think Planet X is
okay. And
what it's not. I believe that Planet X is actually a spent brown dwarf star. I think that it's at least the size of Saturn, but probably much more massive. And I believe that it's a celestial body that is connected to our solar system, very much like Zachariah Sitchin suggests, with an elongated orbit. I'll get into that a little bit more. But this particular subject is little understood and not very much accepted by most modern-day astronomers. Here's my hypothesis.
All right.
Mm-hmm. I believe that we have to examine this hypothesis concerning X's next return through the solar system by going back to biblical scripture and biblical prophecy to begin with. But let's talk about its orbit. I believe that X's extended orbit, approximately every 3,600 to 4,000 years, first passes through the solar system, then back out again, suggesting that X's destructive cycle, George, occurs in two distinct phases. This first phase begins with X's initial pass-through, I believe, around the month of either September or October of 2009,
right,
and then separated by 3 years until its second phase, wherein it makes its second pass through the solar system in 2012.
2012, isn't that interesting?
We're right back on that magical marker point in time.
Now, let's talk about for just a second, Jason, and we'll get back into this, but would you explain to everybody a brown dwarf star?
Okay. A brown dwarf star is simply a luminary body that failed to ignite like our sun did. Now, that's a very simple explanation. But if I tried to get more technical, you know, we'd get lost in detail. Basically, it has mass, it has heat, it does not have the kind of color. That's why they call them brown dwarfs. They're like a muddy red. And that's why on the cover of our book, by the way, I'll tell you about the artist who did that also. He's very famous.
Oh, sure.
We depicted a sun that appears to be in the throes of trying to ignite.
Okay. Now, when you say it has heat, intense heat, maybe not like the sun, but hotter than, let's say, Earth?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But one of the reasons that they can't detect this particular body is because the range of light that it gives off is not easily detected that far away in space. And I also believe that it's coming in from the southern quadrant and therefore coming in from behind the sun. This orbit, let me go into this orbit just a little bit. This orbit is greatly elongated. Imagine if you had a large rubber band and you took a finger on each end of the rubber band and pulled it apart. Its natural shape would be what? Elliptical, correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, great. Now imagine if you could superimpose this huge rubber band over the entire solar system and you could see the detailed line of its trajectory, it would be going out to one side in a very, very, very long, graceful arc. And at some point, it reaches its end, it makes its turn, and it comes racing back toward our solar system. Now, in 2009, I believe that this brown dwarf sun, which, by the way, I also believe is a sister sun to our sun that we see every day
okay.
when we wake up in the morning.
Well, there are some who believe that we have a binary star system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And some of the ancient Sumerian cosmology and much of the information that we were able to find, by the way, we have over 2,000 references in our book, by the way. So if anyone's wondering where we got our facts and information from, of course, we invite the reader to check out at the back of each chapter. Okay. So as it comes in the first time, its mass, its weight, its gravitational field will cause all of the planets to be slightly disrupted as well as affecting our central sun. And what happens is that its mass goes into opposition to the mass and the gravitational field of the other planets in our solar system. And basically what happens is everybody gets shook up a little bit. Now, we do know that NASA has officially announced that there seems to be apparent heating up of all the other planets in our solar system.
And they don't understand why.
It's so simple. The two magnets things. Okay, how often as a child did you have two magnets, and when you put them in close opposition, they did one of two things. They either pushed themselves apart, or they were instantly attracted toward each other, thus going click. Okay. If you had these two magnets and assume that these huge celestial bodies, the planets in our solar system, act like magnets to one another, if they come in opposition to each other's gravitational field, what happens is it either repels them or it excites them. And I believe that the mass that Planet X, which is actually a brown dwarf star, represents, has been affecting the center core portion of our sun and causing it to spin faster and also to cause excitation of its surface features. We do know that sunspots are up. You know, we're coming into a solar max in 2011.
Right. Well, also, I find it fascinating that you talk about a 3,600-year elliptical orbit, and so does Zachariah Sitchin with his planet X's Nibiru planet.
Yes, exactly. Now, and I'm
are we talking about two separate objects or just one here?
Well, if I was to really tell you where I think Nibiru is at this point, okay, why don't we do that? This is go for it, right, sir?
This is go for it, Jason.
All right.
We've got three hours of go for it.
I I think that Sitchin was right smack on target describing Planet X as a planet, Nibiru. However, I don't think that it equates with Wormwood, which I believe is the brown dwarf star, which I choose to call Planet X.
Okay. If
Nibiru has a name, it's Nibiru.
Right.
If Planet X doesn't have a name, and no one seems to know exactly what it is, then I'm going to assume that we can say that Planet X is, in fact, our brown dwarf star.
Okay, that's interesting, because Sitchin never called Nibiru Planet X.
No, he never did.
Other people made that assumption that it was Planet X. So basically what you're saying, Dr. Rand, is that it's possible that there's Nibiru in our solar system on that same kind of orbit, basically, as this Planet X, which you believe is a brown dwarf star.
And now, can I tell you where I think Nibiru has been hiding
sure.
all these years? I think it's in tow behind Planet X or our brown dwarf star, and I'll tell you why. According to Sitchin's work, the ETs, the Nephilim, they come about around here almost exactly every 36 to 4,000 years. At least that was my understanding of what he was writing about.
Well, that's pretty close.
In close proximity to our planet, and that could explain their visits. All right?
Okay,
now,
all right.
We do know that a planetary body this size and of its nature would be pushing and pulling a debris field. It stands to reason. Even asteroids, free-flying asteroids, can either push or tow debris fields. I think that what happens is that Nibiru itself is in tow behind Planet X, and that it does have enough heat and illumination to be able to nourish that planet. Now I know that
let me tell you something.
Out there.
No, not necessarily, because I have always been perplexed at the Zechariah Sitchin theory based on Sumerian texts that he interpreted. There are others, like Michael Heiser, who think he's all washed up. They don't agree with that theory. However, I have always been puzzled at the heat source of Nibiru, especially if it goes out on that kind of orbit, 3,600-year
exactly.
orbit. You have now explained how it could be possible that Nibiru has a heat source, and that's this brown dwarf star.
Exactly, and I'm going to throw one small other point into this equation. We marvel at what appears to be interesting lag periods and jumps in sudden intuition, intellect, and intelligence for the various phases that humanity has gone through the ages. You know, I think we all agree that modern-day man has been around for the last 50 to 75,000 years in one form or another. Now, if this theory is correct, and Nibiru is in tow behind this brown dwarf sun, it would also help to explain, quite conveniently, why there seems to be periodic jumps in mankind's ability to become mature, intelligent, and sensitive, and these kinds of things. Does that not make any sense to you?
Well, it does, and it also explains why there may be periodic calamities, periodic ice ages, and everything else.
Exactly. And now you're getting into the core of the book. Let me explain just throw a little bit of information in about the book, and then I'd like to go on and talk about the relationship that I believe the term Wormwood has in relation to our planet X.
Okay.
The book is 342 pages. It's a glossy paperback, very rich with color and detail, and the front and back covers plus several of the interior graphics were done by a very, very famous graphic artist. His name is Shushi Niigoka. He's Japanese, and at a very early age of 14 to 15, he was commissioned by the U.S. government. They brought him over from Japan, and he did all of the inside murals at the Kennedy Space Center and at the Johnson Space Center.
Ah, okay.
If you've ever been there or are planning on going, or if any of your listeners are planning on going, please let them soak in the beautiful wall graphics. They're mural size. You know, it's like going to the Sistine Chapel, so to speak. This was all done by Shushi, And I have been so fortunate in knowing Shushi now for about the last 35 years. The story of how we met, I'll do that real quick. Okay.
I'd like to hear that.
I've been a record producer, incidentally. I've been in the music business all my life. I go way back to being one of the original Kukla, Fran, and Ollie kids in Chicago on WBBM.
Were you really?
Yeah. I played Curly at age four at a Lutheran church. So I've been in show business a real long time.
Anyway. I wonder how many people even remember Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
Anyway. I was real fortunate to be in the music business, and at the time I was living in South Florida, doing disco records during those days, and I was looking for a new artist to do some album covers for me because I had some pretty way out ideas. I had the pleasure of producing the two brothers of the tribal leader who led the Miccosukee Indians in the Everglades. He was their tribal captain, and they were called Lee. Lee Tiger was the father, and the two boys and I and his band created a fantastic album, and we couldn't find anybody to do the covers. So I go into, do you remember the old Peaches chain record stores?
Yep, sure do.
Okay, well, they had a Peaches chain down in South Miami. So I walk into the store, and I walk over, and almost like divine providence, and incidentally, one of the things I love about your show, and this is not a commercial, but it is a commercial, is the fact that you aren't afraid to talk about anything that a person experiences or tries to understand, and that is so important. I noticed your little commercial before the show began talked about the fact that Coast to Coast provides a great service. You are an alternative voice to Big Brother and also to the field of science, which isn't always kind to people like us. Anyway, so I'm led by this divine feeling right over to this one particular bin of albums. Remember that's when they had the 12-inch albums. That's all there was. There was no such thing as cassettes. And I'm leafing through the albums, and lo and behold, I come across a fantastic picture of what it looks to be a UFO, and it was one of the early ELO albums. Do you remember?
Yes, I sure do.
Blue with silver on it.
Yep, well done.
I saw that cover, George, and I said, "Whoa, I found my guy." So I flipped the album jacket back over, and sure enough, it says Graphic Arts by Shushi Nyagoka, Los Angeles. That's all it said. I said, okay, so first of all, I bought the album because I had to have it.
Yeah.
Brought the album home, and I was probably around 4:30 in the afternoon. I immediately went to long distance saying to myself, well, with all the luck I've been having lately, why not? I'll be able to get him on the phone. Sure enough, Shushi Nyagoka was listed with an address and a phone number. I hung up with the call directory, and I called him. He answers the phone. And now, here you go. He said, Jason, I've been waiting to speak with you. And George, so help me God, I just about fell off the chair.
How strange is that, Jason?
I'll tell you how strange it is, and with good reason. The group of people that I had my first contactee experience with at age 11 are called the Fourth Racers. They come from the planet Epsilon in the star system, Ba'udis, and they are very much humanoid. They look very much Oriental, you know, around the 5'3" height, and it appears that they were also in contact with him as a child, and he and I have spent many, many, many trips with them up on the ships through our childhood. My first experiences began at age 3 and 4 when I was being taken out of body. I remember I couldn't wait to go to sleep at night.
Jason, we're going to take this break. I want to come back and talk about this and more about Planet X, of course, because there are some others who have said that if we do have extraterrestrials out there, they may be coming from Epsilon. I find this fascinating that you believe that that's where you've been going. We'll talk about that when we come back. I want to continue to thank you for picking up the After Dark newsletter, renewing or brand new subscriptions, because everyone, Mr. Al Bielek of the Philadelphia Experiment, gets a donation from us, and this is helping him out tremendously. But in addition to all of this, in addition to the subscription or the renewal, you'll get a CD, an Art Bell interview with Al Bielek about the Philadelphia Experiment. This is a collector's item. It's just our way of saying thank you so we can make this contribution to him in style. Call 1-888-727-5505 to subscribe. That's 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coast2to.com. Jason, there's so many great topics to talk with you about: the Planet X, Wormwood, of course, and now this case for you where you've traveled to Epsilon. I guess let's talk about all of them, but you had left off about Epsilon, so I'll let you pick it up from there. Okay. When did this all start happening to you?
Actually, at about the age four, between four and five, we had just moved to Chicago from the suburbs, and my brother and I shared a bunk bed. I was on the top, he was on the bottom, and my little sister was in a twin. And I remember I couldn't wait to go to sleep at night. I just couldn't wait. I didn't fully understand the dynamics of what I was experiencing, but I was experiencing what's known today as OBE, out-of-body experience. Mm-hmm. And when these events happen to a child, especially if the child has been psychologically prepared by the entities, it is not at all a catastrophic or a fearful situation. I actually remember flying right through the wall, right out into, you know, what appeared to me to be just space with breathing and everything, and it was instantaneous. 1 minute I was in my bed waiting to be taken, because I would not go to sleep. I couldn't wait. And the next second I would be in a place, in a space, in a comfortable situation. And I believe that this happens hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times to people who are especially selected for the experience. Because based on that, my whole mission in life has been leading up to this very project called The Return of Planet X. The last thing that I remember ended around age eight. The OBEs ended, and nothing happened until I was age 11, and at that time, I was on a fly-in fishing trip with my brother and my dad up into Manitoba, Canada. To make a long story really short, I was out in a boat that I shouldn't have been. I got caught in a storm. I got blown to the opposite side of the lake. And as the boat was sinking, some kind of an object, which I later found out to be something called a KBOC, which was an electromagnetic force field that surrounded the little boat that I was in and brought it to shore. The story goes that I spent about 5.5 hours on a very large circular craft. It was the Fourth Racers. And while I was on that craft, I was given an implant, which is there. You can see it under X-ray. And I have to be very careful with MRIs, by the way. And then at the end of that experience, I was shown about an hour's worth of classrooms, what looked to be like a slideshow. You know, mm-hmm, the big plasma screens that we see today?
Yeah.
Well, this ship had pie-shaped compartments. It was quite large. It was like 90 feet across, and it was about 75 feet thick, and it had two levels to it. And the classroom part of it was probably 30 feet across and probably 20 feet deep. But at the end of that 20-foot space to the back of the room, there were a series of 12 plasma screens. And this show that I was treated to was just like you'd see at a regular old slideshow, you know, at a church bazaar, slide after slide after slide. And there was probably no more than 3 or 4 seconds a duration, and then it would go to the next slide. And what it is, the program began on the left, and it went from the farthest screen on the left to the next one to the right to the next one to the right. And when it got down to the extreme far right side of the room, the program started all over again, going back and forth. This went on for over an hour. It did have sound. It was always mentally communicated to me what exactly I was seeing. One of the last images, a series of images that I remember, I was shown Planet X, a Wormwood coming into the solar system. I was shown basically the schematic of it, what would happen. I was told all about how it affects Earth and Earth's history. And then I was asked very pointedly, would I be willing to take on the task? And I was told I would be a musician, I would be a writer, and I would be a teacher. And their prophecy to me came exactly true in the right order and with the right intensity. And so the actual trip to begin writing Planet X began all the way back in 1950 when I was 11 years old.
Is it basically your mission to inform us about this?
Not just my own mission. In other words, I'm part of a large cadre of people. You brought up Nancy Leader. She writes some fantastic things, and I totally understand where she's coming from, and in fact, I read her material. I find it difficult for people to accept her as she is because what she talked about didn't exactly come to pass. But you see, you know, this isn't like looking in, like walking into a mirror and you see exactly what you look like. This is a story which has much complexity, and each of us is given a separate piece of the puzzle. And I only have this piece of the puzzle. You see where I'm going with this?
Okay.
There are many other people.
Many of you have little pieces.
And all of these pieces eventually get to fill in the greater picture, the greater mural, if you will. But on the other hand, the scientific community, the religious community, and the political communities of the world don't want this information out. It's obvious if our planet was to become drastically altered by the passing of a large celestial object, obviously life on this planet would not be like it is right at this moment, okay, on Wednesday morning. And everything is fine. You can go to the grocery store, you know, you can go get gas in your car, go to your ATM, go to the movies. If something drastic happens, our whole life is going to change, not only in this country, but completely around the planet. And I think that one of the reasons I decided to go ahead and go public with the book was to not scare anyone, George. The whole point of The Return of Planet X, the book, is not to scare you. It's to inform you. It's to educate you. It's to share with you the dynamics of what I believe could be a very rough, difficult period beginning in 2009 and possibly ending in a total pole shift in December of 2012. I find it very interesting that all of the old Sumerian and Phoenician prophecies and timelines, and of course that of the Central American Indians, the Yucatan Peninsula Indians. For some reason, December 2012, they say everything hits the wall.
Yeah, I know it. It is strange, isn't it?
And I've got many more references in our book as to other belief systems that all pinpoint to the same date. Incidentally, I did some research, and it's in the book, The Third Secret of Fatima, which has never, ever been revealed by the Vatican. But I believe that it talks about the return of Planet X and the fact that the world will possibly be brought to its knees, and the very fact that the Vatican itself, and I don't want to become suddenly unpopular with anyone, but the Vatican itself may suffer severe damage because of severe earthquakes and the like of that, which could hit Italy at this particular time.
And if that's the case, if this is indeed the third Fatima, mm-hmm. don't you think the Vatican has a responsibility, Jason, to let us know about it?
Yes, of course. Of course. You know, religion is a very difficult thing to discuss, and it's a very difficult thing to legislate. I think that religion has to be understood and practiced and absorbed by each individual human being according to the dictates of their heart and their consciousness. You know, regardless of what particular religious faith, what, you know, and I'm going way beyond just the Christian realm of religion. Now, if this is the case, and we are headed for a difficult period, I think it's incumbent that each of us start to prepare mentally, spiritually, and physically for a change. Isn't it strange how wacko for the last 3 years the weather has been?
Yep.
Even as we speak right at the moment, there are things brewing out there with such ferocity that frankly, none of the countries of the world, especially the United Nations, has any idea what to do with it. Look what happened in Indonesia with that horrible 9.0 earthquake in Christmas of 04.
And are you blaming Planet X, Wormwood?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Causing massive slippages of the continental plate systems. That was a pretty major slippage that occurred, causing that huge tsunami. And by the way, that's the tip of the iceberg. What happened?
Well, let me also tell you something else, Jason, which is strange.
Yes.
That ties in with what you're doing. There was an individual who's been on the show several times who basically saw in 12 dreams a crash of a DC-10, and he notified the FAA. It is on record. He didn't know where it was, but he described the DC-10 to them. Ended up being a plane crash in Chicago years ago that killed well over 200 people.
Lost its engine.
David Booth was his name. David, on the program several years ago, said that he has had more dreams of some kind of object coming up from the south, and it doesn't hit the planet, but it creates devastation.
Absolutely. It does not.
Isn't that interesting with what all of you seem to be saying now?
Well, that's the whole point. And that's, once again, I'm so grateful to be on your show tonight. If we could only get the information out, I believe that the human race is not only intelligent enough, it's intuitive enough to start making its preparation. That recent disaster movie, The Day After Tomorrow,
done by, based on the book of Whitley Strieber and Art Bell, The Coming Global Superstorm. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. What's so interesting about that particular movie was that one event, that one feature film, did more to raise the consciousness of the planet than any other single event, I believe, in the last 100 years. That movie had that kind of an impact on the public. True. The sequences were speeded up, of course, to fit into a two-hour movie. But the point of the matter is that is a very strong, real possibility.
Do you believe astronomers know of Planet X, Wormwood, and they're not doing anything about it?
I do believe that. I honestly do. I don't mean to say that the astronomers of the world are deliberately hiding the material. I believe that they are working under different assumptions, and that they may be under the control of their individual governments. However, I do believe that our government and those of the other governments of the United Nations, as we approach possibly 2009, but certainly by 2012, I do believe that they are going to be forthcoming. There will be no stopping people from seeing this image in the sky.
What will it look like?
It'll be, I believe, the way I saw it, it'll be like a dimly lit shining star, but huge. I believe it's at least the size of Saturn. And I believe that once it finally emerges out from behind that incredible glare that the sun produces, that we will be able to see it. Not clearly at first, but the further it moves away from the fascia of the sun, I believe that we'll be able to see it in the sky. And once that happens, there'll be no hiding the truth. There'll be no reason to hide the truth. People will want to know. And I'm just one voice of 1,000 voices out there, and one idea and one theory, which I believe is all part of a larger pattern. Now, once this information begins to get out there, I think that there will be certainly a glut of books that will come out, and rightfully so. I think there are other authors who might be a little afraid at this point to stick their neck out. I know. By the way, surprisingly, I have had very little negative feedback from anyone. In fact, the Arlington Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the White House. I've sent a book to Senator Trent Lott. By the way, I'm in the state of Mississippi, which was greatly impacted by Katrina and Rita, as you
sure.
Probably remember. I'm and Al Gore has requested a book. I was afraid that I was going to get, you know, a real slap on the wrist, like, you know, who do you think you are? Where'd you get this information? Instead, everybody is quietly absorbing it. And I wanted to just quickly mention to your audience that if they'd like to obtain, can I give an 800 number?
You may do that, and I'll let you give it also at the end of the show when
all
we're
right,
done, too.
Fine.
Go ahead.
If you'd like to order a book, there it's a glossy paperback, 8.5 by 11. It's got 342 pages. The ordering book number is 1-800-247-6553. The company that has the book for distribution is called Atlas Books, and they're in Ashland, Ohio. And I have several websites. I'd like to give you the main website. It's simply returnofplanet.com. That's returnofplanetx.com. And all that information will come up, and information about the book in bits and pieces, and, you know, to tempt them into looking further into the website.
Jason, tell me about the Revelation chapter 8, verse 11,
okay,
which talks about wormwood. Explain that so a lot of people, I mean, we've got a lot of people who read Revelation. They understand
sure.
it. But there are some people, first-time people, they don't know what it is. Would you explain this
I would be happy to. As part of the amount and depth of the research that we did, I kept coming back time and time and time again with the arrow pointing to the biblical interpretation of wormwood that occurs in verse 10 to 13 in chapter 8. It's only four paragraphs. It would be far better if you would allow me just to read those quick four paragraphs.
Sure. It's pretty dramatic, so go ahead.
Very, very dramatic. Okay, I'm reading from the book of Revelation, chapter 8, verses 10 to 13. 10. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as if it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the foundation of waters. 11. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. 12. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. 13. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels, which are yet to sound. This was taken from the Authorized King James Version. Now, I believe that the last return of Planet X coincided with the Hebrew exodus from Egypt, estimated around 1447 BC, which was roughly 3,460 years ago. So, George, I'm going to pose a question to you and your audience. Did God somehow come to Moses' aid by staging a cosmic event that no one today understands?
Very possible.
It would explain for the blood-red running of the rivers and the lakes. It would account for the shower of locusts and the plagues and the parting of the Red Sea when they were making their escape. All of this plays into, yes, it's biblical, but how much of the Bible has today been proven to be totally correct, especially with the excavations going on, that type of thing?
Well, and I think a lot of the stories in the Bible are based on astronomical and possibly extraterrestrial events.
Absolutely. And I what fascinates me is when I talk to church groups, they're absolutely spellbound because they already have the potential belief system to understand that reality is a very, very strange thing.
Jason, when we come back, tell us how close Wormwood, Planet X, will come to Planet Earth. We'll be back.